My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
It's the Wonky Show. Campus protest, is it a free speech issue? We'll do that debate again. Minimum income standard for students. Heppy has a new report out, and UCU are talking about academic freedom. It's all coming up.
I think there's a real issue for the incoming class about how they're enabled to navigate some of these very complex issues in an environment at the very beginning of their sort of academic careers.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Associate Editor Jim Dickinson, and here to go away and sell their cow, as usual, three brilliant guests. In Colchester in Essex, Anne-Marie Canning is Chief Executive Officer at The Brilliant Club. Anne-Marie, your highlight of the week, please.
Oh, Jim, it's been a lovely week, mainly because I've managed to finish an essay that I've written for a forthcoming collection in memory of Sir Bob Kerslake, so a civic universities piece. So it's always nice when you manage to finish something after a few drafts. So, yeah, it's been a highlight of my week.
In York, Ben Vulliamy is Chief Executive at the University of York Students Union. Ben, your highlight of the week, please.
The highlight of the week for me was Bank Holiday Monday, sandwiched between a Roses sports tournament and a series of protests. I went paddleboarding to chillax in my wetsuit.
Well, there's an image. And in Axbridge, Somerset, Livia Scott is Partnerships Coordinator at Wonky. Livia, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week has been that it's starting to get sunny outside. It actually feels like spring now. So, yeah, that's my highlight.
And I don't normally do my highlight, but obviously my highlight is I'm at Eurovision and Croatia are going to win on Saturday. So all very exciting. Yes, we start this week with protest. We're recording on Thursday morning. And as we speak, a select group of vice chancellors are hurtling their way to Downing Street, Livia.
So, yeah, Rishi is preparing to meet vice chancellors later today to discuss how to kind of prevent US-style protests over Gaza spreading to the UK. Although, you know, a lot of the protests, if you're talking about the camps, there's a lot of university campuses across the UK that already have them. But I presume this means he means more in kind of escalation and size when he talks about the US-style protests. The government has also hinted that there will be a specific mention of how to prevent anti-Semitism included in a condition of registration on the Office for Students' powers to prevent harassment. So OFS will be able to kind of levy sanctions on universities who allow anti-Semitism to happen on campus and also investigate the claims of anti-Semitism at specific campuses. So now the government kind of is claiming that much of this is new and shiny, but OFS have always been planning on releasing the outcomes of their recent harassment and sexual misconduct consultation. What is new is that there's going to be a specific mention of anti-Semitism within that. There's also likely to be new guidance from ministers for universities on how to deal with potentially anti-Semitic protests and prevent outside groups infiltrating on campus. But we don't yet know how that will kind of appear. We presume it will probably be prevent. I think where this gets us to is that you've essentially got the government who've up until now been pushing a really big kind of maximalist frame when it comes to free speech and a kind of small minimalist one when it comes to harassment. So kind of a smaller, very narrow definition of what constitutes as harassment under the law. And now when it comes to anti-Semitism, and we've kind of seen hints of this when Robert Halfen was talking about kind of specific duties for OFS when it came to anti-Semitism and the kind of specific anti-Semitism czar that he was talking about a few months ago when he was still a minister. But now we've kind of got the government flipping that on its head and wanting to kind of take a maximalist frame for harassment and a minimalist one for free speech. And it just, none of it seems to make any sense. And I think if I was a student, I would be just so confused as to kind of what the rules were. Like, can I protest? Can I not? Is it okay? Is it not? I don't think anyone seems to know, even the government, to be honest.
Yes. I mean, it's there are kind of shifting sands in the rhetoric here, aren't there, Ben?
Yeah. I mean, look, first off, I think it's preposterous that the Prime Minister summons vice-chancellors and university leaders in this kind of deeply performative way. It's never a serious conversation if you invite the media to the room. I mean, that's just a simple fact. So he's pulling away university leaders from their campuses, which they're trying to manage, and pulling them to this kind of performative showdown with the Telegraph and whoever else. Whilst he postures to the gallery, whilst the Prime Minister postures to the gallery, there are real people on campuses trying to manage campus safety, student well-being, trying to enable the responsible conduct of free speech, trying to bring people together in a grown-up dialogue about international tensions. We aren't puffing our chests out to the gallery. We're trying to have a conversation that's got some compassion in it, that tries to hear a plurality of views and needs, and Rishi's sense of urgency to kind of ramp up the anger and the fear is probably not going to help the situation.
Yes, interesting. I mean, Anne-Marie, if we look at the sort of, you know, the kind of politics of the harassment consultation, there was barely a word about racial harassment in there. It always obviously did cover racial harassment in the legal definition, but there was barely a word about racial harassment when it originally came out. It was very much framed around sexual harassment. So the sort of adoption of this late-to-report consultation on harassment and sexual misconduct is actually really interesting in terms of the way the government is now latching onto it to argue that it has a solution on anti-Semitism on campus, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously late to the game on that inclusion around racial harassment, and likely should have been there from the beginning. But I do think it is legitimate for us to pay attention to anti-Semitism at this moment in time. Like, it's very clear, like, we've had a serious spike in those sorts of incidents in society at large, not just on university campuses. And so it's probably a case of sort of, can we, you know, bring this in at the final moment and address what is a very topical issue at this moment in time? But I will say, I tend to agree with Ben on this one. I have had either the fortune or misfortune to be called to one of these number 10 breakfast summits, which is usually a sign that I think the government is in somewhat a state of panic about an issue. There's no real sort of tool or approach being sort of suggested. There's no proposition on the table in terms of how we would deal with this. It's generally like, get people together and bang their heads and see what happens. And it's not the action of, you know, a well thought out plan as to how we handle what is a very complex and increasingly complex situation on some of our university campuses at the moment. So yeah, it's, you know, a late addition, but as I say, it's a moment in time, isn't it, right now? And it's in some ways understandable that the government would pivot in this way at this moment.
Livia, obviously in the next month or so, I think it's probably now safe to assume that there will be an expectation that universities will introduce new students to the parameters of the free speech duty in September. And also, presumably, an expectation that universities will introduce students to the parameters of the preventing harassment duty in September. And I was thinking about this yesterday when I was kind of bodding around Copenhagen, thinking, if I'm a new student and I want to know where the sort of bounds of free speech and harassment start and end, the conversation about what constitutes anti-Semitism, particularly if the war is still going on, that's going to be unavoidable, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I was chatting to a few kind of student union colleagues the other day, and I think this is the thing that I think everyone just feels like they're banging their head against a brick wall with, because you've got this sense, and you've got students who have been promised in brochures and kind of on the website and through regulation that they will not experience this kind of hostile and toxic atmosphere on campus. And they've got the government promising, like for Jewish students, for example, that they will be able to feel safe and things like that on campus, and they will not they will have this zero tolerance approach, if you like, to harassment. And I'm not saying that we should kind of allow harassment to happen on campus Like, that's not what I'm saying at all. I just don't understand how universities will be able to do this zero tolerance approach when you've got kind of one sandbag of the free speech legislation on one side, and then you've got this kind of really minimal, only within the law, legal framework of harassment. If I was a student, I wouldn't have a clue what is and isn't okay. Like, I think you've got some commentators saying you can't protest at all on campus, and you've got Arif Ahmed kind of saying, well, you can protest, but you've got to do so in a safe way, but no kind of sense of what on earth a safe way is. And then you've got the other side, and you've got Arif Ahmed 2 years ago saying, well, academics weren't able to kind of publicly express views on Israel or Palestine. And it's just like, it feels like every week we get a new thing, and a new thing that is okay and a new thing that isn't okay. And I know that's not, you know, that's not the kind of reality of what's happening on campuses, and that's not how students draw lines. But I worry that the rules aren't clear. And we've always, and when I talk to students, where students draw lines of what is and isn't okay has always been, I think, different to the law. And I think this is where we're going to get to. And when we've got no kind of clear rules on what isn't okay, or you've got one rule for one type of harassment and a different rule for another, it's just a total mess that I think students won't know, because the academics don't know, the staff don't know, the SU don't know, the government don't know.
Ben, obviously, your congratulations. You're shortly off to AHUA to support registrars around the country. And I guess on the one hand, you can make a really decent set of legal arguments about what isn't okay. You can seek legal advice and so on. But on the other hand, both of these agendas are aimed at changing the culture on campus. And when you're trying to change the culture, you're not calling a solicitor, are you?
No, you're not. You're having conversations with real people. And that's the difference. And there's this kind of fascinating comparison for me. So these are, we are thinking about these as student protests, as, you know, carried out within the domains of our universities, et cetera, et cetera. And starting to think about and converse about, you know, actually, you know, maybe there's a question for Rishi about what's happening on the streets in London or in Westminster, in the debates that are complex and difficult and need nuance. And this isn't a student-centric problem. Actually, to the credit, but also the risk of universities, they've been quite collegiate in some of these protests and these expressions of free speech. They're inviting friends and neighbours, staff and students, local community groups, Amnesty, and so on and so on. They have a range of voices talking in a variety of ways that in many respects role model a more, not all the time, and we have to call it out when they don't, but often they role model better standards of behaviour because of the way registrars and security teams and students' unions and many, many others are trying to talk with students about how they can keep themselves and others safe.
I mean, it is fascinating this, in all seriousness, right? I mean, I'm in Copenhagen for Eurovision in Malmo, and last night I couldn't get to the venue because there was a protest on the Øresund Bridge. And interestingly, the local press today are reporting that that's a mixture of students from Malmo University, high degree of which are commuter students from the local community, and other protesters. And it's interesting because, of course, in the press, this is painted as elite kids at elite universities having, elite childish conversations. And to some extent, that's true of the way it's been portrayed in the US. And one of the things I'm interested in, Anne-Marie, is the extent to which we should consider this as a kind of Russell Group issue, or whether there's something wider potentially going on here in terms of culture on campus and the involvement of people from all sorts of walks of life.
Well, one, I think the first thing to say, Jim, is there's a really interesting point there around the blending of sort of students and broader communities of activists and so on and so forth, which has always been the case, but is always much more pronounced on particular issues where there's already clearly established, like, interest groups, activist groups, campaign groups. I don't think it is an elite issue, I have to say. If I think about some of the universities that you wouldn't put in that Russell Group bracket, where this is a very live issue, it seems to me that it's not a sort of part of the sector, but actually it's a broad-based issue for universities. Do you know, it's interesting listening to this conversation today, because in some ways it reminds me of like the relationship on access and participation, which is the sector shouldn't wait for a regulator to come up with guidelines about how it should steward campus culture on issues of freedom of speech and harassment and so on and so forth. It's very clear that universities should own the issue and create the processes and sort of opportunities for students to engage with this kind of agenda when they get to university. So Livia's point about, like, you know, a student coming to campus, starting their course this autumn, I'm going to be honest, as an 18-year-old heading off to the University of York, I was really active politically on the domestic front. I had no idea about Israel-Palestine. Maybe that's embarrassing to admit, but it was only when other students took time to explain to me, like, some of the parameters of what's going on there, the history and so on and so forth, and I went away and understood it, that I was able to sort of navigate that discussion amongst my peers and amongst sort of students in my seminar room. And so for me, it reminds me actually a lot of some of the work you can do around campus conversations, collective discussion in the early parts of a university experience that allows students to start to get a feel of, like, you know, here are the ways we behave on this campus. Here are the ways we can interact. Here are some of the sort of parameters. And here are some of the principles of freedom of speech as well, and academic freedom of speech particularly. So for me, I think there's a real issue for the incoming class about how they're enabled to navigate some of these very complex issues in an environment at the very beginning of their sort of academic careers. So, yeah, it's a really, really careful process that I think universities should own whilst the regulator decides what it wants to do.
But Livia, all of that is really interesting, isn't it? So if I think about the kind of history of the debate around sexual harassment, in some ways, we have quite rightly moved on from a boys will be boys clip around the ear. They slowly need to learn by getting it wrong how to treat women, right? So, you know, we've moved from that culture to, no, actually, you do need some actual rules. You can't just tolerate all sorts of harassment just because people are young. But at the same time, if we regard this debate as one that's educational and people can kind of explore and so on, there's a danger, isn't there, that Jewish students will experience the kind of unlawful or at least deeply, deeply harmful and unpleasant anti-Semitism that other debates, where in other debates we've resolved, no, people shouldn't have to experience that. They should, you know, fine to have an academic debate, but not a debate that, you know, makes you feel oppressed on campus. And where we decide that something is, you know, a learning experience where people can get things wrong or something to be ruled out from day one is a really hard line to draw, isn't it?
I think the thing is for universities is to try and work out kind of how do they want campuses to feel? What do they want? How do they want students to feel safe? Because that's the thing that they promise, is that all students will feel safe on campus. I think, and I said it earlier, I think there is a sense that, you know, students will come onto campus and they may interact with other students who've got different opinions to them, and they may interact with people who have views that they do not agree with. And I guess the kind of crux of the matter is that those things are fine, but how do we kind of make sure that those things are done in a safe way for all students involved? And is it possible? I don't know at this point.
Yes, I guess it's partly about being really careful about the word safety, isn't it? Just as it's, you know, about being careful about the word and freedom. Ben, just before we sort of finish on this, obviously the sort of, you know, the kind of tick box compliance approach would be to buy a module off the shelf on free speech, to buy a module off the shelf on harassment, tell all students they've got to complete it. Bob's your uncle. If OFS knock on the door, you've done your duty. But in your head, is there something else perhaps that universities or student unions ought to be doing, thinking about this over the summer in preparation for a kind of new clutch of students to arrive who will be kind of managing these twin tensions in their own heads?
I think you're bang on the money that the summer becomes a really critical period to think, you know, with a bit of space to think. I get slightly frustrated by the amount of people who've been in touch from, you know, all sorts of areas within York and wider afield, kind of asking for the risk assessment. And I'm saying, I can share the risk assessment, but it's understanding the people and being able to walk up to them and ask them how they're feeling and listen to what they reply that's going to make the real difference. That's what's going to help us get through this. And doing that in ways where, you know, I mean, yesterday we had a series of protests in York, and I saw four different members of the university executive board speaking to leaders of both Jewish student communities and Palestinian communities and Amnesty and UCU and many others. And that's a really positive thing. And so I think I'd spend the summer thinking about the networks and the, you know, the inductions for new students that encourage conversation, encourage this really kind of, you know, a bit like Livy was saying, we need a deeper understanding of what safety really means. And I do think there is this, you know, I really think if we want to change the conversation nationally and, you know, move into a slightly less binary space, a less performative space, you know, wouldn't it be interesting to see how a university's definition of safety compares with the Met Police's who are trying to police London, you know, because they're probably different. And we have some, you know, campus environments have some different structures and systems and cultures that we can use to our advantage, frankly. But trying to understand those different advantages, it maybe we find that actually we're doing a better job of keeping people safe and helping them explore difficult, uncomfortable things about the world around them on universities. We're perhaps doing a better job of it than the wider public. I don't know.
Actually, just one other thing before we come off this, Anne-Marie, right? You might have seen in the kind of background, Trinity College Dublin, a similar encampment. And about a week ago, the encampment and various other protests, you know, the university fined the Students' Union €200,000 for blocking the entrance to the tourist attraction that they have in the middle of campus. But actually, the thing that's happened this week is the protest encampment is now gone, and the university has announced it will divest from investments in Israeli companies that have activities in the occupied Palestinian territory and appear on the UN blacklist. Trinity will endeavour to divest from investments in other Israeli companies too. Big announcement, and you know the student activists are claiming a win here in Westminster. Again, in the background, the boycott bill is about to legally prevent universities from responding to that kind of call. And it does seem to me that it's really, really easy for people like us to sit and talk about this in terms of education and safety and listening and so on. But actually, these activists want a thing to happen. They have a set of demands. And one of the questions, I guess, is whether universities should seek to respond to those demands or whether they should never respond to those demands, which is the kind of Westminster government's view.
Oh, this is taking me back to my student union days, Jim. I'm having flashbacks here. It's really interesting about the fining, isn't it? Sort of using tools and sanctions that you've got available to you in a sort of new situation. Yeah, really interesting. Look, this divestment stuff was happening when I was a student union officer back in like 2007. I remember coming out of a university council meeting and there was a die-in outside of Heslington Hall. So thousands of students had just laid down to protest divestment of various companies.
Thousands, Ben.
I'm sorry, folks. It seemed like thousands. It was on the front lawn of Heslington Hall for anyone who knows York, probably hundreds. But I remember picking my way through them to get out of the hall. Anyway, it just reminded me that divestment was, you know, a major negotiating point for various student groups. Not the student union, actually, but student groups at York. And so this is like a strong tradition on campus around negotiating on these sorts of issues. And, you know, more recently around climate and divestment there. It'll be interesting to see sort of the intersection with the boycott bill. I mean, obviously, universities will have to abide by the law. But, you know, it's all about how those two processes potentially come to join in the middle. But yeah, it just reminded me of this rich tradition around campaigning and negotiating and demanding divestment. It's been there for many decades on our university campuses.
And look, but you know, just to end on this, Ben, just finally on this. I don't want to keep bringing things back to Eurovision. I don't want to be kind of childish about it. But in all seriousness, the European Broadcasting Union is finding it really, really difficult because most years it bangs on about its values of inclusivity and diversity and so on. And there's a group of fan activists principally, but quite a few other people that are arguing that allowing Israel to still take part is, you know, a betrayal of those values and so on. And it does seem to me that both universities and students' unions are the sorts of organisations that like to say they have values, but then find it, one of which is democracy, I might add, but then find it really quite difficult when some of those, you know, the execution of those values come under pressure in the real world of kind of funding and politics and conflict and so on.
Yeah. And I mean, you strike on a slightly sensitive spot for me. The Students' Union in the University of York runs half a dozen bars. On the one hand, we've got a bunch of students saying we want to host a Eurovision party here. On the other hand, we've got a bunch of students saying, why is the Students' Union showing Eurovision? And actually what I'm saying is, I'm afraid we don't ban particular flags from singing. We don't do that. So we will support the students who want to host the dance party and the Eurovision watch party. We will simultaneously reach out to the Palestinian Solidarity Society and ask them if they want to have a stall at the entrance point so they can share their views. You know, like, that's what we practice, is free, you know, sensible, moderated, careful, considerate, responsible free speech. And it does mean we are, you know, stretching ourselves a little bit thin on a Saturday in the middle of May, because we're going to host half a dozen Eurovision parties and half a dozen protests.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Well, look, plenty more on the site on all of this. Doubtless there will be developments to come, both on harassment and the summit at number 10. Now let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
So hello, I'm Jackie Potter.
And I'm Laura Milne, and we're from the University of Chester. In this blog, we talk about learning architecture. This is a higher level of activity than learning design, which is what goes on in a module. This is about the big decisions that structure curriculum at a university, such as module choice, module credit volume, and the shape of the calendar year.
Many universities are making reforms to learning architecture by bringing in new learning design frameworks. We suggest that these won't resolve the financial difficulties universities are in, but they will go some way to bringing in new efficiencies. And most importantly, they have real pedagogic value and some benefits for students.
The Festival of Higher Education is back for its second year. This November, Wonky and the University of London will welcome you to Senate House for two amazing days of one-to-one conversations with HE leaders, set-piece debates and insights from journalists, policymakers and experts. You'll hear from speakers inside and outside the sector, take part in amazing interactive sessions, learn about new research, data and ideas, and meet colleagues, old and new, all equipping you with fresh thinking and insights, ready to take back and share with your universities and teams. It's going to be an unmissable event for anyone with an interest in the future of UK higher education in what will be a critical year for the sector. That's 12th and 13th of November in London. Tickets are on sale now. They went quickly last year, and once they're gone, they're gone. So find out more, book your tickets at thefestivalofhe.com or follow the links on Wonky. We can't wait to see you in November.
Now, next up this week, Ben, HEPI has a new report out on student standard of living.
Yeah, that's right. So a new Higher Education Policy Institute report shows that students outside of London living away from home need £18,632 a year in order to have an acceptable standard of living. And the report, which was developed in collaboration with Loughborough University's Centre for Research in Social Policy, who I think helped developing the methodology for the original real living wage formula, have proposed a minimum income standard for students, an estimate of what students need to participate fully in the world around them. And so this goes beyond, you know, those kind of core essentials, rent and food, etc., and starts to think about a kind of full annual budget, your haircuts, your laptop, your weekend away, and so on and so on, is the equivalent of establishing a living wage for students, and starts a debate about financially sustainable mass approaches to supporting students' basic needs, very similar to that we have in other areas of the welfare state or in workers' rights, etc., etc. The report doesn't make the case that the full amount, which will vary depending on accommodation type and region, and is estimated to rise to £21,774 in London, it doesn't argue that it should all be met by maintenance. But the report does argue that there needs to be an uplift in student maintenance and an increase to household income thresholds that determine those loan amounts. I think it's really interesting that you know, we're starting to provide a definition and think about the solutions to fall back on for basic essential living standards. I think it should be the hallmark of a developed country, that we're a country that don't ignore poverty and try and instead break cycles of poverty through targeted action to pull people out of that kind of decomposing impact of living without basic needs and standards met.
Yes, I mean, Anne-Marie, this is a really interesting kind of intervention, isn't it? Because, you know, it's really easy to say that maintenance loans should go up by inflation, but if they haven't gone up by inflation for 3 or 4 years, there's no point arguing they should go up by inflation because the amount that you're arguing they should go up from was wrong. So, you know, having a definition of the amount that students need is important, isn't it? But here's a question for you. If the country can't afford it, should we give students less than they need or should we have less students?
Well, I'm going to say less than they need rather than I'm dead set against student number controls and capping, and I see them as a major structural barrier to widening participation. So I'm always going to come down on the other side. But here's the thing. I love this report. I think it is one of the most important reports we've seen in higher education and student sort of finance and well-being. This methodology is so important. So I'm a trustee at a major child poverty charity. Minimum income standard, the fact we've now applied this to student living, it's incredible. It's a landmark moment. Few things from the report, because I have read it in depth and I just, yeah, it's just fantastic. First of all, everyone should read it. The requests from students in terms of what makes for a decent living standard are very, very modest.
Yeah,
very
they're hauntingly modest, aren't they?
Yeah, the moment where they're talking about, we'd really like to have a TV in our shared house so we can watch TV together because we can't afford the cinema. We can't afford to go out for a drink. We can't afford... It's just really, really heart-rending, actually. So please do read it. There's lots of discussion about fairy lights and potted plants as well. So it's lovely. Please read it. The second thing is, related to your question, Jim, it's very clear the government is not going to give us a maintenance settlement that covers the entire gig for students. And actually, the report works out how many hours a student would need to work to sort of top up their income. Couple of things about this. One, the report doesn't take into account any university contributed funds, as in the bursaries, which we know are variable across the sector. So I understand why it didn't do that. So some students will be getting a bursary. I think this makes a really clear case for gap funding through philanthropy, similar to what we see at the US universities. It's clear we've got a gap. Some of that can be made up through work. Some of it will be made up through bursaries. I think it's also very clear that there needs to be a significant rise in philanthropic scholarship funding, bursary level funding for students across the UK. And that is one of the mega trends I think we'll see over the next few years, which is we'll see civil society stepping into this space to support students. At least I hope they will. And I will certainly be making that case at the Brilliant Club on behalf of poor students.
Yeah, I mean, Livia, in many ways, the report isn't actually particularly strong on, you know, how you pay for it or the kind of diversity of students and so on. And I guess nor should it be, because that wasn't the focus. And to some extent, regardless of where the money comes from, as Anne-Marie says, maybe from philanthropic giving or from, you know, bursaries or whatever, just the idea that we should establish a minimum is probably fairly helpful. But one of the things that did strike me reading it was, obviously, we're just back from another European study tour where all four countries that we visited have got a real focus, not just on giving students enough to live on, but on reducing the costs that they face. And one of the things that really strikes me looking at some of the numbers that are in the report is, shouldn't we also have a proper focus on getting the cost of public transport or accommodation down rather than just defining all of that as educational loan spending and then giving students enough money to get into debt to pay for it?
When I was kind of reading through the report, I think one of the things that I really wanted to see in the recommendations, and again, it wasn't the point of the report, but was around, we're probably, like we said before, we're probably not going to see a maintenance increase for students. But I think where there is one thing where there is probably space for a real win over the next kind of few months and 18 months or so is around transport costs, particularly, you know, we've got more kind of regional control with local mayors when we had the elections last week. And kind of if we get a new government, I think one of the things that we're going to see is a focus on transport. I don't think I saw a mayor or a kind of a candidate who didn't have something about public transport in their manifestos. And I think there's a real space for kind of student unions, universities and kind of student activists, but ideally other people in the sector, kind of not just students themselves, to advocate for cheap transport costs for students. For example, in Manchester with the Greater Manchester Student Partnership, they've been advocating for a kind of student price on all public transport. particularly one that isn't restricted by age, because that's something that often happens, you know, only kind of under 24s or whatever. And I think if universities, student unions and that sort of thing can kind of really push for that together, I think we will start to see some kind of real big wins for students. I guess the other thing off the back of what Anne-Marie was saying around kind of alumni donations or philanthropy, I think there's a real space for universities in the UK to get braver and to be a little bit more honest about the kind of realities of students' lives. I think, you know, I think there's a, and I do it, I find myself kind of guilty of, you know, we've been talking about cost of living for kind of 2 years now and years before that, but particularly this kind of crisis, if you like. And I think there's a sense that universities don't always want to admit just kind of how brutal some of the lives and how complex some of the lives that students at their universities might lead. And I think kind of anything that universities can do, similarly to what they kind of do in the US, to kind of be honest about the fact that not all students will be able to meet all of their basic needs. And that's not just a thing. That's not just because of kind of maintenance loans. That's just because of the realities of some students' lives. And I think basic needs centers like what they have in the US is something that I think we need to get towards within UK universities. I know Leeds SU has got a brilliant kind of pop-up version of that where, you know, students can kind of drop in and get food. They can get kind of toiletries and all of that sort of thing. But I think where this stuff works is where it's not just the student union kind of funding it and doing it themselves. It's where the university is quite honest about the fact that this is needed, funds it, uses alumni donations and all of that good stuff to kind of enable students to kind of study and live well while at university, which is, I think, what this kind of report was trying to get at.
I mean, you know, it is fascinating this, Ben, isn't it? Because, you know, for understandable reasons, whenever I ask that kind of trick question, the question I asked Anne-Marie earlier, I understand why most of the sector falls on the access side of that, you know, made up question rather than the no restrict student places question. But it seems to me that if that's what the sector does, my argument would be that creates a responsibility to be much more honest about the costs of being a student and the realities. And, you know, you will know, Ben, that I've published all sorts of articles that seem to suggest, at least in my head, that universities are really, really struggle to be honest with students about how hard it can be.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the accommodation debate is the start of being honest about that. The fact that some universities are having to acknowledge there is a maximum capacity to this institution, and it is irresponsible and dangerous for us to take on people that would exceed the housing that's available. But if you think beyond that, you know, the implications for public transport and then across the city, or for healthcare, or for refuge management, or for bursaries, or whatever else, I think maybe we've started to be honest about the extent of our, you know, our capacity, our resources, our energy. But it does need to go a bit further.
Before we finish on this, Anne-Marie, I'm kind of really interested in the, if you like, the sort of machinery of government stuff on this, because, you know, over on the living wage thing, you know, there's a real infrastructure around updating those numbers every year. The Labour Party have committed to adopting the real living wage rather than the Low Pay Commission's version of the way it does the living wage. And actually, over in HE, we might get a student income and expenditure survey every 10 years, and occasionally HEPI might produce a report. And there's a danger, isn't there, that even if there is a student finance review at some point in the next, you know, term or two terms, that it's not annually updated and we don't improve our intel on what amounts to over 2 million people in the population.
Yeah, the thing about minimum income standard and how it's used in other sectors and for other groups in society is it's an annual update of the basket of goods and what it takes to live as a decent human being here in the UK. So it has to be a commitment to update annually, and then it sinks into things like the real living wage levels and accreditation. So you're absolutely right. It's got to be a commitment to an annual review, knowing that we've seen all sorts of fluctuations in recent years. So it's even more vital nowadays.
Great stuff. Do take a look at the HEPI report. Really good piece of work. Now let's see who else has been blogging for us this week.
Hi, this week I've written about what higher education should be doing to save the planet. It can feel like there's nothing we can do to stop climate disaster, but it's important to remember that humans have changed the climate before. In fact, that's what got us into this mess, and that time, we weren't even trying. What could we achieve if we do try, if we create a whole generation with this mission as its core purpose? At the Engineering Professors Council, we take this very seriously because we recognise that engineers played a role in creating this climate emergency. We also know that we'll be at the heart of the solutions we find to avert disaster and to manage to live in a changed world. We've created the Sustainability Toolkit, a suite of resources to support engineering academics to thread sustainability throughout everything they teach. And this made me wonder, what could other disciplines also be doing to embed the new skills and mindset that we're going to need to address the biggest challenge we could ever face? Do please take a look at the piece and at the toolkit and let me know what you're doing in your discipline too. Thanks.
Now, our editor Debbie has been looking at manifestos and the way that higher education manifests itself in those manifestos at general elections. Here's more from Debbie.
Hi, it's Debbie McVitie here, Wonky's editor. And throughout this term, I'll be working with Adam Matthews at the University of Birmingham to dive into how higher education has showed up in the main Westminster political party's general election manifestos. We think this will give us a bit of interesting insight into the politics of higher education throughout each decade in the post-war years. This week on the site, you can read my analysis of manifestos of the Liberal, Democrats, Labour and Conservatives during the 1940s and 50s. Not surprisingly, in the 1945 election, which obviously was held just at the conclusion of the Second World War, there's not much said about universities. The country, frankly, had bigger concerns. All political parties were debating how best to rebuild after the devastation of the war. And of course, you know, fewer than 5% of young people actually went to university at this time. I think, you know, in the kind of modern parlance, we'd say HE was very much not what we call a doorstep issue. But what interested me is that as the 50s wear on, particularly against a backdrop of the expansion of secondary education, and then, of course, the kind of debates that fell out about exactly what form secondary education should take, whether it should be grammar schools, whether it should be comprehensive and so on, we can see the seeds of a developing political consensus around expanding higher education. And crucially, supporting fair access to university. It certainly doesn't look much like what we would think of as widening participation. But by 1959, you can see the Conservative government, who was then in power, talking about one third expansion of places, about taking advice from the Anderson Review, which it had commissioned to look at student grants. And you can see Labour committing to a state grant for every student. What you can also see there, I think, is in the 50s is just how difficult a time it was for the country. There was a long tail of economic challenge as the country sought to recover from the war, and an awful lot of anxiety about what was going on in the world with the rise of the Soviet Union, terrifying new technologies, creating kind of geopolitical tensions, specifically in this case, the hydrogen bomb, which was the kind of the successor to the atom bomb. You can see a little bit of the seeds of that sense of looking to science and technology as this kind of threat or possible saviour, both to kind of help economic rebuilding at home, but also to sort of cement Britain's place in the world. Obviously, as any historian will tell you, this is not something we cannot read our current situation from looking back to the 50s. But I think there's something quite important to understand about where Britain is now and where it has been in the past, and where triangulate that with where higher education has showed up. So we do see that kind of the beginnings of science and technology being asked, sort of mobilised as a political agenda in this decade. But most of all, there's that sense that, you know, looking towards the 60s and what became the kind of the real push on higher education expansion, you can really see the seeds of that at this time.
Now, finally this week, UCU has a new report out on academic freedom, Anne-Marie.
Yeah, so this is a new report from UCU and researchers at the University of Lincoln looking at academic freedom and digital transformation. And, you know, what that means is increased use of technologies like module evaluations, virtual learning environment, things like lecture capture and recordings, their impact on academic freedom. So how colleagues in universities are feeling, that presents a sort of a sense of... Yeah, sense of surveillance and continual performance management. So UCU did a rather large survey. They talked to about 2,000 university staff. A couple of interesting headlines. There are a lot of headlines, but here are one or two that I thought were particularly interesting for listeners. 60% of respondents felt that academic freedom had declined in recent years, but that most of them still felt their university had an above average level of protection for academic freedom. 90% felt that monitoring through digital systems was a form of increasing institutional control. Although half of them said that it had increased student voice and feedback. There's all sorts of interesting things in here. But what I will say is this is not just an issue for academic colleagues in universities. It's an issue for all workers who are using digital tools to carry out their work. So really interesting piece of work from UCU.
Ben, one of the things that I thought was really interesting about this was on Twitter the other day, someone was referring to that 14% of students who don't feel comfortable to speak on campus, and they were saying, well, shouldn't we be worried not about the 86%, but the 14% who aren't part of the pro-trans left-wing monoculture? And what strikes me about the report is that it nuances the debate around academic freedom beyond the way it's been framed in the culture wars, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does, and that's starting to mature the conversation. There's this irony, right? That in the Brexit style debate, you know, we decided that fractionally over 50% of enough people of the electorate was enough to decide our kind of future relationship with Europe. At that same time, Michael Gove was talking about I'm fed up of the views of experts, right? And we're now only now, years and years on, are we starting to move beyond the idea, you know, the idea that we're obsessed with the views of experts, and actually we're trying to have a more mature debate about what does academic freedom look like? How do we promote ideas of discovery and exploration and pushing the boundaries of what we understand, what we engage with, celebrating difference? I mean, I think universities excel at that, and they aren't doing it by counting, you know, putting the 14% against the 86% or the Brexit-style 50-50 debate. We aren't doing it by dismissing the views of, science against humanities or whatever. We're doing it by creating whole institutional approaches where students and staff and the wider community come in to celebrate and explore and discover new ideas.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out how we can keep you and where you work ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the site and click subscriptions. So thanks very much to Anne-Marie, Ben, Livia, Debbie, Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.